finally getting to Schedule 3 brings all of our tenants back into a normal taxation regime, which reduces their tax liability, improves cash flow, and quite frankly, I don't know of another regulatory change for any REIT that's had a significant credit improvement for its entire tenant base the way Schedule 3 will have.
Good morning. It's Monday, May 6th, and this is Deconstruct, a podcast from The Real Deal. I'm Isabella Fall.
And I'm Susanna Cavanaugh. Today, we're talking about cannabis and specifically as it relates to real estate. So I chatted with Anthony Coniglio. He's the CEO of New Lake Capital Partners, which is a publicly traded REIT that specializes in leases to state-licensed cannabis sellers. So the market has really gone through a big shift since he opened up in 2019. You know, we've seen more and more states legalize both recreational and medical marijuana. And last week, we actually got some pretty big news from the DEA as far as the classification of cannabis as a what scheduled drug it is. So we're going to get into that, how it may affect his growth going forward, the growth of New Lake. But first, let's get into the news.
Let's start with WeWork. The co-working company is making its way through Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceedings, but has finalized a deal to come out on the other side.
And notably, the exit plan doesn't involve Adam Neumann, right? The former CEO?
No, it doesn't. There was a lot of chatter about Neumann coming in and buying the company, but this plan does not involve Neumann at all. WeWork announced a plan to shed $4 billion in debt and raise $337 million in new cash from Yardi Systems and $112 million from existing bondholders. Yardi Systems should sound familiar to everyone. They have a large property management software business that I'm sure many of our listeners use. And it's interesting, WeWork was making this pretty big pivot to software before it filed for bankruptcy. So there could be some sort of alignment there.
WeWork has also been working to keep some of its leases, shed others, and modify another third. They're kind of in three different buckets, from what I understand, having spoken to their spokespeople. For example, it's keeping leases in LA, Long Beach, and Orange County, but it's unwinding itself from leases in San Jose and Houston. New York is kind of a mixed bag. And on each lease assumption, WeWork negotiated a different set of terms. So on some leases, the landlord agreed to reduce rent and guarantees for WeWork.
With office being the way that it is, these deals do show that WeWork has some leverage with landlords, given how much space they took. It's not that they took like a suite or two there in a building. More often than not, they had, you know, one or two floors in an entire office tower and had leases going through, you know, the 2030s.
So one example of that is actually 750 Lexington, which is a Charles Cohen-owned building. So WeWork stopped paying rent on that building in October. Its lease made up about a quarter of 750 Lex, which there are other landlords that, you know, have WeWork, as you said, Isabella, as their only tenant. So that's devastating. That being said, you know, just this 23% lease, WeWork hasn't totally exited. It also hasn't said it's going to stay. It hasn't really said what its terms are going to be there, but the valuation of that building was cut by 83% in April. So you can see how the hit to revenue will really affect the performance, the value of these properties.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure that serves as a warning sign for other landlords. And there is some incentive there, I'm sure, to say, okay, we'll work with you to, you know, if you do extend your term and agree to stay, we will reduce rent in some cases.
So speaking of Charles Cohen, Fortress Investment Group has launched what would mark one of the largest UCC foreclosures of all time. It filed to foreclose on a portfolio owned by Charles Cohen and his firm, Cohen Brothers Realty. And senior reporter Keith Larson had that story.
I know you've reported on Cohen's struggles before, but how much is Fortress claiming Cohen owes on this?
Right. So this loan in particular is collateralized by a number of different properties. There's some in South Florida, a design center. There's a project up in Westchester, and there are a bunch of theaters. So all told, it's a $549-ish million loan. And I will say that Cohen is facing distress of different degrees. Some loans are in special servicing, some are watch listed, but most are struggling with occupancy. that's tied to about $500 million of debt just in New York City alone. So all told, distressed debt is sort of nearing $1 billion for him.
Wow. Very wide reaching. And just a reminder, a UCC foreclosure stands for Uniform Commercial Code Foreclosure. And it's an option for mezzanine lenders to foreclose and own a project. Mezzanine lenders can put a property up for sale through a private or public auction if a borrower defaults without going through a formal court process.
So we're going to be tracking that foreclosure, seeing what comes out of it in the next few weeks.
That's an example of a redevelopment site in distress. And in LA, actually, this developer Millennium Partners just pulled plans to build this giant $1 billion project in Hollywood, which was going to have two office and residential towers and more than 1,000 units in total. It seems like developers are being much more selective about where to build right now, and some are falling into distress, some are just walking away altogether, some are pushing forward.
So just all plans are out the window. Do we know why?
There was a vague statement, but no, we're looking into it. We've seen some developers try to score extensions on plans, hoping to wait and see what interest rates do, but pulling plans seems to signal that they want nothing to do with the site, right? And it's interesting because in New York, we have others forging ahead with new dev, which is definitely rare to see right now. The Naftali Group, run by Mickey Naftali, has unveiled this 1 million square foot project in Williamsburg, which will have 850 units across 5 22-story towers. It's right on the Williamsburg Wharf, so right on the water.
Right. And what's the price tag there, cost-wise?
$600 million. It's still in the design stages, but Naftali has already spent $285 million on the actual land. He bought it between 2019 and 2022. So all up, we're edging closer to $1 billion here.
Okay, let's get into our interview with Anthony Coniglio, CEO of New Lake Capital Partners,
which is a publicly traded REIT focused exclusively on the cannabis industry.
So can you break down exactly what New Lake does?
So we provide real estate capital for the cannabis industry. We acquire properties from and for cannabis operators for cultivation facilities as well as dispensaries. We focus on triple net lease arrangements almost exclusively.
Just so we're laying the groundwork here, it's only cannabis operators that are state licensed, right? Because in New York City, after Cuomo legalized marijuana recreationally, we had all these little like shops that popped up,
but
they do not have licenses from the state.
Correct. Yes, we only focus on state legal businesses that are licensed, and we actually spend a lot of time in our underwriting, understanding the licensing of the jurisdiction they're in and verifying the licensing and making sure that they stay licensed during the course of their tenancy.
So you founded New Lake in 2019, and the market has changed a lot since then. That was 5 years ago or so. And at that point, I believe there was a bill introduced that would have legalized marijuana on the federal level. I remember there being a lot of buzz around that. Obviously, that didn't pan out, but did it affect your decision to open shop that year?
No, it did not. Our thesis at New Lake is that the normalization and legalization of cannabis is undeniable and will occur. And so we wanted to be one of those early movers into the sector and capture that opportunity while there was that big moat around our business model driven by the differences between state and federal law when it came to cannabis. And so if we were able to figure out that mousetrap and how to provide capital to the sector, we think we could create significant value for our shareholders.
I do want to ask about how you've grown since 2019. There has been a slow rollout of states legalizing recreational cannabis use. Amid that environment, how did you pick and choose what markets you liked?
Yeah, when we started the business, we recognized that it was more than just a real estate business. We recognized that you needed to really understand the cannabis industry itself, particularly because each state approaches cannabis regulation differently. And that really formed the basis of our underwriting approach. And a core tenet of our underwriting approach is understanding that jurisdiction. And we like more limited licensed states, states such as an Illinois or an Ohio or a Pennsylvania, that really treat much more restrictively in terms of the sale and distribution than unlimited licensed jurisdictions, say Los Angeles or in Colorado or in Michigan, where there could be thousands and thousands of licenses. And we think that approach has really served our portfolio well over the last few years.
Pennsylvania is medical still, is my understanding. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So you have a presence in the medical space, not just recreational.
Yes. Our tenants are operators of both medical cannabis operations as well as adult use operations.
When you're looking for spaces in the markets you're looking in, you mentioned Ohio, Pennsylvania, how competitive can things get?
It's not extremely competitive for us because there aren't many folks that have been able to get to scale and have the type of capital capacity that we do. And we've been developing relationships with the industry over a course of 5 years. And I know that doesn't sound long to a lot of folks, but in the cannabis industry, where lots of capital providers tend to come and go, there really has only been a handful of us that have consistently provided capital to the industry. And so it's not a tremendous amount of competition. In fact, if you were to compare it to regular commercial real estate, quite frankly, it's a fraction of the competition you would see on a typical commercial real estate capital.
In terms of when you go into a shop that has a state license, they're very specific. You know, there's security measures and there's no windows. So how hands-on are you as far as outfitting the spaces to comply with state regulation?
We provide the capital. We certainly do review the plans, and we make sure that we're comfortable with what they're building and that it conforms to the regulations. But in terms of the design and the actual build, we do leave that to the tenant and we'll provide the capital for the build out once we can review and verify that the construction's been complete.
I also wanted to touch on the cultivation facilities.
Yep.
I'm just curious what that market looks like. Is the market crowded?
Yeah, I would first say that we don't actively find locations, seek to get them entitled, and then go out to try to find a tenant. Our tenants and our target tenants have typically done that work for themselves because it's so critical to their overall success. And so they have teams of people that go out, that source the locations, identify the locations, will work on the licensing, and they bring us in as their capital partner. But your point is a good one because the restrictions on a state-by-state basis often have setbacks, whether it be from houses of worship, whether it be from other cannabis businesses or from liquor stores, or might be restricted to certain industrial areas for the cultivation facilities that we support. So it really does vary state-by-state, but it can be difficult. For instance, New Jersey is proving to be very difficult for people to find affordable locations for their cultivation.
Is that because of what you mentioned about you said houses of worship, alcohol, or is it because New Jersey is pretty tightly populated?
Well, it's a number of factors. Number one is the industrial market in New Jersey is very hot, and so there's limited supply available. Number two, many towns in New Jersey opted out of participating, taking a wait and see approach. And so that can further limit the number of available properties to the industry. And then number three, because of the tightness of the market, the price point for some of these properties is pretty high. And there's often what's called a cannabis tax. Often what you find is cannabis operators need to pay a premium to market to secure the property because the seller of the property knows that those companies are typically in a bind with limited options.
I wanted to sort of turn to an equities angle a bit. You're a REIT. You know, REITs have had sort of a roller coaster ride. I feel like we could say 2021, they were up a good bit. 2022, back down. 23, up. 24, I think we're down a little bit for this year. You know, I was looking at New Lake stock. 2022 was a little tough for you, but things have been on the upswing since October 2023. How do you differentiate yourself from other REITs in the space? Do you think that the performance of New Lake shares have sort of followed that trajectory, or are there key differences there?
The performance of our stock has less to do with the movements in the general REIT industry and more to do with specifics related to our company. And quite frankly, the difficulty with operating in cannabis. So if you went back and looked at a stock chart, you'd see we IPO'd in mid-2021 at $26 a share. We had nice demand for our IPO. We saw that demand continue into the aftermarket. And for months following the IPO, our stock moved up through the high 20s into the 30s and getting into the mid 30s. And then what happened in the fall of 2021 is custody agents, these are prime brokers that service the institutional equity base, custody agents changed their rules with respect to custodying stocks for what are called MRBs, marijuana-related businesses. JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Pershing started to communicate with the institutional investor base, saying that they could no longer custody or would no longer custody marijuana or marijuana-related stocks. And so we became swept up in that. And so that, I think, depressed prices for the entire cannabis community and the ancillary businesses. And once we rectified that, and then we were able to demonstrate the power of our portfolio, particular versus some of the comparables, that's when I think you started to see our stock recover. And we really started talking about some of these big catalysts here in 2024 that can move the stock higher.
So let's get into some of the good news this week. The DEA said it would reclassify marijuana as a Schedule 3 versus Schedule 1 drug. And then just for some context, ketamine is a Schedule 3 that's being used therapeutically at this point. Schedule 1 is heroin. So that's a big change. How does that affect you all?
It does keep marijuana on the illegal list. So it continues to be illegal. And that's a misnomer. Some people see this headline and think, oh, we're legalizing cannabis. Well, it still remains illegal. It's just moving from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. And I would note fentanyl is actually Schedule 2.
Wow.
It's kind of wild to think that cannabis was scheduled higher than fentanyl.
Yeah.
But we're rectifying that. As Schedule 3, the biggest change for the operators in the sector is the removal of the onerous 280E taxation. So there's a provision in the tax code that says that if your business that is selling product that's listed in Schedule 1 or Schedule 2, that you are not allowed to take ordinary tax deductions for your business, and you're limited only to cost of goods sold. The impact on the industry is that it has been suffering from paying an effective 50 to 60 to 70% tax rate given the limitation on those deductions. And so finally getting to Schedule 3 brings all of our tenants back into a normal taxation regime, which reduces their tax liability, improves cash flow. And quite frankly, I don't know of another regulatory change for any REIT that's had a significant credit improvement for its entire tenant base, the way Schedule 3 will have for our tenant base. And as you know, for a triple net lease REIT that has 14 years of remaining weighted average lease term, it's all about collecting rent. And collecting rent is all about the financial health of your tenant. And if all of our tenants are getting this boost to their free cash flow by reducing the amount of taxes they've had to pay, that's a significant credit improvement in our portfolio.
If you're looking over the next 5 years, what sort of growth are you anticipating? And I guess I will also tie in, obviously, as we discuss this news about the DEA reclassifying is not legalizing recreationally, but do you expect that to happen on a federal level in the next 5 years, or do you have a time frame for that?
Let me first talk about growth, and we'll talk about time frame and evolution of regulation. So our growth primarily comes from three areas. First is we have annual escalators across the portfolio, and they average currently 2.6%. So every year, revenue goes up by 2.6%. Number two, we have tenant improvement commitments for projects that as those dollars go out, and as of the end of the fourth quarter, our most recently reported quarter, our earnings are next week, as our most recently reported quarter, we had about $15 million remaining. So as that money goes out for those projects, we'll have additional revenue. And that's our second category. And our third category is our nearly $90 million credit facility, which is almost entirely available to us. We'll utilize that to enter into new transactions, which will generate additional revenue to the business. Now, in talking about this regulatory reform, we do think that this announcement by the DEA and a move to reschedule to Schedule 3 will have an impact at the federal and state level. When you think about growth for the industry, it will come from, without any further reform, it will come from states that have recently approved adult use. For example, Ohio, at the ballot box, this red state in November approved adult use 57% approval. That program is expected to launch and convert from medical to adult use sales this summer. And so that's going to provide meaningful growth opportunities for those that operate in the state. Many of our tenants do have operations in the state. We do have a property in the state. You'll also have growth for states that adopt medical. And so you're seeing a very nascent medical program get off the ground over the last year in Georgia, as an example. And then you're going to see additional states like Florida, extremely exciting opportunity in the industry. Florida is medical today. But that state of over 20 million residents at the ballot box this November will vote on adult use. And if that passes, that's going to usher in significant growth. And then at the top, you started talking about federal proposals and bills that were put forth. In fact, yesterday, Senator Schumer and 16 other senators put forth a proposal to completely legalize cannabis. Now, I don't think that legislation or that bill has the support to become law, but whether it was that CAOA Act that they proposed, I should say reintroduced, it's been reintroduced before. Congresswoman Mace last year or earlier this year reintroduced the States Act. There's a safe banking provision. So there's lots of federal action that's going on around the industry. And I do think it'll take time. I do think we'll ultimately see legalization of cannabis, but I think it's going to look more like the alcohol model across this country, and it'll be where they leave it to the states to regulate. I just think it's going to take time to get there, but we feel confident that it will happen over time.
Deconstruct is every Monday on Apple, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Or you can listen at therealdeal.com. For comments on this episode or on the series, or if you have a guest or idea you'd like to pitch, feel free to reach me or Susanna at podcasts@therealdeal.com. Next week, we'll be airing our interview from TRD's New York Forum. We'll be talking about distress, loan extensions, you know, all things to do with defaults, delinquencies, and more. Tune in then.